Surprise!
Surprise! I want to curse.
you can.
No, I can't. So, I'm not cursing.
It's like, surprise, biatches. We're not calling our listeners biatches.
We're not going to call our listeners biatches. Welcome to Bush and Banner, hosted by me, Diana Carmella, and the wonderful, vivacious, energetic Jennifer Mabus is with us.
I am with you.
It's nighttime where you are right now.
Yes, it's, you know, what do they say? We're burning, or I am burning the midnight oil.
She's burning the midnight oil. We have a special little surprise for you guys. This is not in our regular lineup. Our third season of Bush and Banner doesn't start until next month, mid-June. But we wanted to put this out there. This is a little present for you guys. Jen, who's on the program today?
So his name is Ned Tibbetts, and I really wanted to do this bonus episode because of the crazy snow year that has happened on the West Coast, particularly in the Sierra Nevada mountains. Now, Ned Tibbetts hiked the Pacific Crest Trail in 1974. He was 17 years old, and they believe he was the 20th person to thru-hike the PCT. And since then, I think he said 41 years, he's been hiking and giving mountain education and guiding. And I mean, he's an expert in all things mountain, snow. He's been worked as a ski patrol. I mean, he's done everything, right, Diana?
I am just learning about Ned, and I am so looking forward to hearing this conversation. You know, let's just put into perspective too. Jen approached me wanting to do this episode because the snow levels are so ridiculously high this year. The PCT hikers are just entering the Sierras. Is that correct, Jen?
Some of them are. Yes. I mean,
okay.
Obviously people start the PCT over a course of several months, but some hikers have made it to Kennedy Meadows South, which is the mark of entering the Sierra Nevada mountains. And there's just so much snow, and obviously there's a lot of nervousness and anxiousness. And if you're following any of this on, you know, Instagram or Facebook or anywhere trying to do your own research, you're seeing, you can like feel the intensity of how are through hikers going to get through. And Ned Tibbetts, he's so confident in what he says because he lives it. He does it every day. He breathes it. Obviously, you want to do your own research. You know, you don't want to take what happens in this podcast and just run with it. The goal of this, though, is for anybody who is currently through hiking, going to start their through hike, or planning on doing a section hike at the Pacific Crest Trail, the John Muir Trail, the Tahoe Rim Trail, or just doing day hikes in these areas with this high snow. We wanted to get this episode out to help maybe calm some people's nerves or give some people some advice. From an expert, not me or Diana.
No, definitely not me.
Yes.
I heard Lake Tahoe got 700 inches of snow, and the record is 812, I believe. So it's crazy. The snow is absolutely crazy. And I'm looking forward to this.
It's going to be a really, really good one. It's a very informative, educational episode. I'm expecting Ned to just take the reins and basically just take over and just share as much information as he can. We could probably talk for 10 hours. I mean, this guy is filled with so much information.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to have him get some main points across, maybe about some gear, how to safely traverse some areas, why this snow year or why this year in general is so much different than other years. We're just going to try to cover a lot of bases.
And so if you are hiking in the snow anytime soon, you have to listen to this episode. You're going to be, we have a little a surprise for you too. This is just going to be Jen today. It's going to be really exciting hearing Jen and Ned shoot the shit, talk about snow safety and hiking in snow. So it's just going to be the two of them.
I'm sure some of you guys will be relieved by that. Yeah, some of you will be relieved.
Get a break from me, but some of you probably are turning this off because it's like, no Diana, no me. I get it. You guys, you're my super fans.
Don't turn this off, though.
Don't turn it off.
Even if you're going to miss Diana, Ned's going to bring some really great information. And I just got to say, he is just a fantastic guy and has this amazing organization. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more, I'm sure, in this episode. But you know, stay tuned and see how you can support this guy who just literally cares about people getting out into the outdoors, enjoying it, but being safe and coming home alive. That's the main goal, right?
That's the main goal. All right, I'm going to set you up. Are you ready? Jen, good luck. We're all rooting for you. Ned just entered the lobby. So after some technical difficulties, he's here. Ladies and gentlemen, please give it up for Jennifer Mabus and Ned Tibbetts. And the show must start. Here they are talking about snow safety.
We have Ned Tibbetts online, and super excited to be able to sit down and have this conversation with you, Ned, especially because of the current, we'll call, climate in the Sierra Nevada currently with all of the snow that it has received. But before we get into all of that, because you are an expert, I wanted you to share a little bit about how you got into, you know, backpacking and through hiking in the wilderness.
Oh boy, you're getting personal on me right from the get-go. Oh my God.
That's right.
Please. All right. You know, I grew up the last kid in a family of four, and we would spend summers driving around the country and going to Forest Service campgrounds. And my dad liked to ride rivers and golf and fish and stuff like that. From a young age, I was involved in getting in the dirt under pine trees and looking up at mountains and swimming in lakes and junk. And summer camp was a big deal. I got huge stories on that for many years. For a month in the summer, I did that. And then heard about the Pacific Crest Trail via Eric Ryback's book that came out, 71 or 70 or something like that, when my mom happened to see an article, tiny little thing in the San Francisco Chronicle newspaper saying, you know, Eric Ryback is coming through town on a book signing tour and he hiked this trail. And she pointed it out to me and was like, what? You know, caught my attention right away. And of course, had to have his book and read about all this fantastic, gnarly stuff that he saw and did. And I said, I want to do that at age 14.
Wow. And, okay.
You know, so my dad had recently passed away in 1969. And my mom said, hey, you know, if this is, I think she kind of maybe secretly doubted that I would pull it off. But, you know, she said, hey, go for it. So took me 3 years to plan it. You know, we had, you know, no internet or nothing. So everything was done by mail. And you waited weeks for responses from Forest Service entities to get their map or their statement that they had no idea where the trail went. And anyway, yada yada goes on. And so in 1974, I hiked the Pacific Crest Trail, which didn't exist in Northern and Southern California and only really existed in the Sierra because there was a John Muir Trail, Tahoe right. Yosemite Trail, mm-hmm. And Oregon, the Oregon Skyline Trail, and the Washington Cascade Crest Trail. So some places I had trail, other places I simply didn't. But that trail, it is still doing with everybody, last comment, changed my life. And back to you.
So at that point, when you hiked it, how many people did you think, you know, yeah, the trail wasn't complete yet, but how many people do you think had completed the trail at that time?
According to PCTA records or Pacific Crest Trail, I call it the administration, but I know it's association. They say I'm in right around number 20 for to have ever done it. And those who did it that year, I was in the beginning of, because I left March 14th. So I didn't know anybody was behind me. I met one hiker all summer. So I was out there for 5.5 months and met
one. Oh my gosh, one hiker.
one through hiker, yeah.
So that year, 1974, when you did hike the Pacific Crest Trail, there was a lot of snow. It was a high snow year.
It really actually wasn't. You know what? I anticipated the question, and now I can't even see the answer. Behind me somewhere is this chart from the snow lab up on Donner Summit saying that 1974 got about half as much snow as this year. But of course, this year was, you know, off the charts, huge. So it was. I would say a normal winter. As normals go, end quote. But I had snow all the way to about a week short of the Canadian border. You know, of course, July in Oregon, you know, can have, I was on 1 to 3 feet of snow off and on.
Okay. So you brought up the year you hiked being about half, just about half the amount of snow that is currently in the mountains for those thru hikers attempting to thru hike the Pacific Crest Trail this year. Do you mind sharing a bit about why this year's snow levels and snow conditions for thru hikers is different than some previous years? Like what, you know, because you see all over social media and the news and Facebook and, you know, people are like worried and frantic. And yeah, can you explain why that is for our listeners who don't know what's going on?
You know, that's great, but they shouldn't, they don't need to be. And I keep trying to tell people this and show pictures from the last 41 years that I've been up in the Sierra during May and June, teaching these my snow skills and stuff like that, that it doesn't make any difference how much snow is there because of the time of the year that the hikers are there. They're there before the whole thing starts melting out, ideally anyway, which would be the month of May, which is something I called many years ago the secret season, because the snow is hard, it's frozen. It's smooth. There's no sun cups. There's no holes. There's no post-holing. There's no creeks. Everything's covered over. It's a big white sidewalk and you just have a blast out there. But if you go in after it starts melting, then it's a pain in the butt because you're floundering, you're wallowing, you're
post-holing.
It's extremely exhausting. It's tweaky on the knees and the ankles and the back every time you fall through. So for the smart people who started early in March, they'll hit Kennedy Meadows South or the gateway or entranceway of the Pacific Crest Trail into the Southern Sierra right around May 1st. So therefore, this is May 3rd. We're talking today, and there's a whole bunch of people stacked up on the porch at the Kennedy Meadows General Store going, mm-hmm. Oh my God, you know.
Trying to maybe wait out the snow melting or something.
They're waiting for Jennifer's recording. Right. To find out what it's really going to be like for them. Because really, because in honesty, it doesn't make any difference how thick the snow is if you can walk on top of it. And even exactly. If you are in there late, because right now what's going on is the last couple of weeks we've seen a warm up. What's happening in that phase is that elevations with temperatures that are above freezing at night are clearly thawing out. So it started out at about 6,000 feet and down was thawing out. That would be a couple weeks ago. It started climbing up to 8,000 and 10,000 feet just recently, maybe in the last 7-8 days, to where those areas were starting to get soft, which means to the hiker, it's just the snow is soft. It's not nasty yet. But nevertheless, now, what's happening? A cold front is descending the West Coast out of the Gulf of Alaska, bringing additional snow, not a lot, but some. But what it's doing, it's causing a lot of shade, a lot of overcast, a cold air mass, and it's dropped the ambient temperatures at night to where the snow is refreezing. So voila, it's wonderful right now. Secret season has reappeared, and the snow is perfect for walking. And according to recent pictures taken just a few days ago by the California Department of Water Resources snow surveyor, John Ditley, and you'll find him on Facebook.
Yes. Yeah, I know. I've seen his posts. Yeah.
Perfect. Showing, maybe 10, 12, 15 feet of snow at the Tyndall Creek crossing, mm-hmm. which would be about 11,200 feet. Well, this is a little porthole that he was taking a picture looking down so that you could see the open water.
Yes, I saw that picture that he posted, right?
So see, there you go. For all the hikers listening, after a normal to heavy winter, this winter was huge, doesn't even fit those categories, you're going to have sufficient snow in the month of May to walk right across the creeks as long as the temperatures support it. So these hikers really do have to be watching weather reports and ambient temperature recordings to know what they're walking into.
So those hikers right now at Kennedy Meadows South General Stores, that's as PCT Through Hikers, we know that's basically the start of the Sierra portion. You are encouraging, as of right now, today's May 3rd, saying you can safely go hike the Sierra in the snow.
Ditley was just there. I'm in there every year, May 1st.
So,
looks the same.
And there's so much snow. So as we know, in previous years, once as the months go on, it's going to start getting warmer and the creeks are going to start becoming raging, we'll say. When do you expect that to happen this summer?
Good try. Good try, Jen.
Come on, give us something. Yeah,
that, No, everybody
sees. You have the answers, right? You have all the answers.
That's what everybody wants. They want to plan, armchair plan their hike. They want to know when this does that. When it comes to the weather, you never know. It's like what just happened. It warmed up. Now it's cooling off. Yes. I think it's going to cycle like this for the next month until it finally kicks in when the temperature readings for the through hikers. Now you're really looking at a Sierra average elevation of about 11,000 feet. Or so, when the ambient temperatures at night rise up to freezing or 32 degrees Fahrenheit and then stay there or climb further, they know then the thaw is on at that altitude or elevation. What to expect, what to see, would then they will already have noticed it. See, like when the snow is refreezing every night, you get up in the morning, you're walking on crunchy, frozen, solid snow. You're not post-holing. Everything is grand. You get going at a nice time of like 6 or 7 in the morning. Come mid-morning, it's just sort of softening a quarter of an inch on the surface. No big deal. You know, by mid-afternoon, almost time for you to quit because you're only doing a mile an hour on snow. You can't go fast or you fall down. You know, you might have an inch of soft snow on the surface. Everything underneath is hard, frozen snowpack. Now, as the temperatures at night warm, you'll notice, oh my gosh, about noontime, I've already got 2 inches of soft surface. As the temperatures warm up even further into the month of May, about noontime, oh, maybe you're sinking in about to your boot tops or 6 or 7 inches. So they already, as they're progressing north, noticing, even if they don't have a temperature that records low temperatures at night, they're already noticing that the snowpack is warming earlier progressively as the days go by. That gives them plenty of heads up when the sun cups are going to start forming, because that's they'll start forming with a thaw. If you've got 20 feet you're standing on, that whole mess actually will probably start ponding first. The surface water that's created with obviously the solar radiation and the ambient temperatures, the surface water will be absorbed by the snowpack, drift down, and further consolidate the pack. But you'll also get some surface ponding. I've seen ponds about as big as a car or maybe as big as a semi in size, not depth. Sitting on the snow, like, you know, hey, cool, there's some open water. You know, let's pump that for drinking water because I can't get to any creeks. I can't get to any open water that's flowing. There you go. Use that. Filter it. But because there'd be lots of bugs and lots of wind-blown debris in it. But nevertheless, you don't have to use your stove fuel to melt the snow anymore if it starts ponding. So that will happen. I probably lost track. You got me too excited on the subject.
No, I love that because part of through hiking, and I think one of the main challenges for most people when through hiking is learning how to relinquish control. And when people ask me advice on, you know, they're about to go do their first through hike, you know, giving them advice. And I try to tell people to learn how to be really comfortable with being uncomfortable and learning how to adapt and change and just go, you have to go with the flow. So I really like what you said about it's up to the hikers to pay attention. And like what you were describing, you know, pay attention. When do you notice in the start of the day when the snow starts to get maybe a little bit soft? What time? And then what time is it the next day and the day after that? And so what you're saying is for the through hikers or the section hikers, whether they're doing the PCT, the John Muir Trail, yes, even the Tahoe Rim Trail, you know, all of these, you know, or just you're going day hiking to pay attention. And I really like that. So you can't just go, you shouldn't just go out and be like, oh, cross my fingers. There should be some education behind that. So I love what you said, because you can't control Mother Nature. And I'm from Reno, Nevada, and so a lot of my friends and family still live there. And they literally were texting me pictures today with snow outside their houses, down in low elevation, Reno. Why is it snowing in May? You don't know. It's just Mother Nature does what she wants, right?
Yep, that's right.
So, okay, so we talked about with the snowpack right now, it's safe to walk on the snow. But what are some other potential dangers that, you know, hikers might see being in that kind of environment?
It's safe to walk on the snow at particular elevations.
Okay.
Back to that. It's warming at certain low elevations, but as you go higher, it gets colder and colder and colder. Mm-hmm. So the folks want to go into Yosemite right now, right? Okay, oh, let's get to some trailhead and let's do some Yosemite backcountry stuff. But that's at like 6,000 feet. I mean, the valley is at 4. Mm-hmm. The rim is, 8 maybe?
Yeah, trailheads average goes up 6. To 10. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, that snow could be really soupy, you know. So you got to know your elevation. So back to education. That's why my wilderness school back in 1982 when I started, it was called Mountain Education. If people do their research, people look into how the mountains thaw out, then they'll know what to prepare for. The problem comes where they just blankly, let's go hiking, you know, and then we have an experience like what happened to, not me, but when I was hiking the Pacific Crest Trail in 74 on Mount San Jacinto, I ran into a party of 5 young college kids who went out for a day hike, didn't realize there would be snow, continued to go, you know, forward and up the mountain in the snow thinking they could, didn't realize it would take so much time, so much effort. They got stuck. They got lost. There I was in the twilight with the stars out thinking I hear voices nearby in a meadow. And my God, they thought they were going to die. And this happens all the time. Still does. I was in search and rescue for 5 years in Tahoe. I lived in Reno for 8 years recently. So I know what you're talking about. But yeah, this happens all the time. People don't do their homework.
Yeah. And especially, you know, Southern California, you know, people think like Mojave Desert, you're going out for some hiking, you know, why would there be snow in Southern California in the middle of summer, right? And people get, when they find out, yeah, when I climbed San Jacinto, there was snow, not a lot, but you're just people. And I met like day hikers there and they were like, what is going on? It's so cold up here. And I'm like, cause you're at elevation. Exactly. Yeah. You know, elevation changes things. So for the through hikers going through this really snowy section, are there pieces of gear or essential items that you recommend they carry?
Well, sure. But let me preface that.
Yeah.
Gear does not make you safe. You can bring stuff, but if you don't know how to use it, I mean, this is the caveat. So for example, everybody knows, and I did find some of my toys. I didn't think I was going to. Everybody knows what an ice axe looks like.
Yeah, Ned's holding up an ice axe.
Yeah, this is an ice axe. This is a very old one that I still use from like 1970. But I use it because, watch this, it is forever long.
Yeah, okay.
It's about 3 feet long. Now, most people think, oh God, I got to carry that damn thing. I don't want anything that long. It's heavy. But then they realize when they're actually out having to use it, it's ineffective.
You're going to want that. Yeah, you're going to want that longer length.
You're actually making yourself fall over if you try and use a short axe because you got to bend over to slam it all the way down in the snow. Because what is an axe when you're hiking? It's not a pole. It doesn't have a basket. It's no good for balance control. So then you're out of balance because you've got a pole in one hand and an ice axe in the other. You can't control where your head goes. That's what your poles are for. See, summer hikers don't understand this stuff because their feet don't slip. When you get on snow, suddenly your feet are going this way and that way, and you never know which way because you're stepping on surfaces that are canted left, canted right, canted forward or back. And so you lose your balance all the time. Your poles are to maintain your upper body. Your upper body will go in the direction of gravity. All it needs is your feet to slip, and you just start going that way. So if you don't have poles with baskets, like most summer hikers don't, so therefore the through hikers coming up from Southern California probably don't. They don't want them because they get stuck in bushes and stuff. I mean, it's a bigger basket. I mean, for example, a snow basket on the end of a pole. the actual, the little dots here are about the size of your summer basket. So you can see that the winter basket is so much bigger, but it's like a snowshoe. The bigger the snowshoe, the more flotation.
Right.
If you have a little snowshoe and you stand on it on soft snow, where's it going to go? It's going to sink in. Mm-hmm. So you need a big basket on a pole or even an ice axe. Back in my day, they made these, good God, they were bigger than a plate, you know, baskets that went on the bottom of your ice axe. So you could use your ice axe as a pole because it was 3 and 4 feet long. Might as well use it as a pole.
Right.
So that's one of the things you need to have. However, most people don't know what to do with an ice axe. And if they try, it throws their balance off. So why just beat that thing to death? Here is a self-arrest pole. It's a marriage between an ice axe and a ski pole. So you'll see that it is
very long
all the way mm-hmm. down to the basket. You'll also notice it has only one buckle, so it's two sections. It is not three sectioned. That means it's going to have fatter tubing around. I don't have a skinny version, which will be stronger. You need your poles on snow, and this gets back to your question for safety. Your poles are a safety tool. They need mm-hmm. to be strong. Therefore, don't get the carbon version of this black diamond whippet pole that I just showed you. Mm-hmm. Get the aluminum versions because they'll be stronger, larger diameter. You've got it in your hands. You got your poles in your hands all the time. Your arms will get stronger even if you're adding a few more grams. So
yes.
You will get used to it. So people got to get over that. Just use it.
I do want to say a lot of the thru-hiking community is obsessed with like lightening their pack, trying to get rid of weight. And I see the benefit in some areas, but then there's other areas like what you're talking about is I've carried heavier trekking poles. And I've never had one snap ever. And I've used them for like 3,000 miles. But there's other people who had to replace like trekking poles like 5 times because they're so light and so skinny and they're just constantly snapping. And so this is one of the areas where you're recommending your ice axe, your poles to not skimp out on the weight because it'll make it safer.
No safety device. I don't care if it's in your car, your bicycle, whatever. You don't skimp on the safety gear.
Agreed. Okay.
It needs to be 5 things. And I don't know if I'll remember them all right now, but it needs to be durable, functional, reliable, repairable. You know, like that's why I went to aluminum. You stay away from the carbon because what happens when carbon gets bent? When you fall down or when you take your pole and you stab it out to the side because you're falling and you want to catch your balance with your pole, because your upper body is moving and your pole makes a plant in the snow, the pole starts leaning forward and you're pushing as hard as you can on it to prevent yourself from falling. So the pole bends. Carbon splinters.
Mm-hmm.
Am I going to be able to do a field repair of that? Probably not, but aluminum will bend. Bend it back. Keep going. So
I agree. Yeah, the integrity of carbon, once you've damaged it, lowers compared to other like aluminum.
Yep.
Okay, so you have the ice axe and what did you call that? The trekking pole or the self-arrest.
Very good. Very good. Self-arrest pole.
Oh, thank
you. That's what it's called.
That's right, Ned. You're a great teacher.
Boy, good student. I love this. But let me just make sure people understand, whoever may be listening. An ice axe is a climbing tool. Yes, it is the definitive thing for what climbers need them for, as anchors on a traverse or chopping ice or being on slopes that are greater than anything a thru-hiker is going to see. But if you have nothing else, if you can't get your hands on a self-arrest pole, then bring an ice axe. So let's just make sure we understand that. But just remember that your ice axe is not a balance protection, balance control tool. So it will, if you deploy it and use your ice axe as a pole, it'll probably cause you some shaky times of imbalance and may encourage a fall. And should that happen, you have the ability with the pick. So back to this guy. This is called the pick of the ice axe. This part here is called the ADZ. ADZ. It is
you're pointing to the, just because I want our viewers or our listeners who can't view it. Can you go back to the front and we'll explain what you're pointing to?
So at the top of an ice axe is a picky, pointy thing. This part right here. In my case, it's about six or seven inches long. This is an old guy that was intended for climbing. And they're rated for strength and performance as a climber, a trained climber would need it. At the other end of the head of an ice axe is shaped like a letter T. So on one part of the upper head of the T is a pick thing. And on the other side is this broad, sharp, chipping thing called an ADZ, A-D-Z. Then you have the shaft, which is the full length of the ice axe, down to the very point, for if anybody can see this. But anyway, that's what an ice axe is composed of. The self-arrest pole, this was a device created by ski mountaineers. People skiing to places to climb a mountain, or they're going over like Ditley did, going over or through mountain passes and cols and climbing arete and peaks and things. They fall down once in a while on skis, and they don't have an ice axe in hand because they need poles, right? As skiers, you need poles for balance. Right. Snow hikers are no different. You need poles for balance. So these guys way back when, back in the 70s, I think, if not 60s, said, hey, well, let's just stick an ice axe on top of a ski pole and duct tape it together and do that. Somebody thereafter, probably Paul Raymer, came up with the idea of let's just make this thing so that, you know, ski pole all the way down to pick.
All in one.
It's all in one. So who knows when you're going to fall? Nobody ever knows when you're going to fall. Suddenly you're falling. You just have to pray that you have your ice axe in your hand. Oh, no, it's on the back of my pack. Oh, I'm going down. It's not. You have no way to stop or arrest yourself in this wild tumble down the mountainside. However, if you've always got a self-arrest tool, like the pick on a self-arrest pole, it's always in your hand, no matter when you suddenly go down. Solve the problem right there. Both two problems, maintaining balance and stopping the crazy fall.
I love that. I only have an ice axe, but that is something great for me to know in the future to look out for and potentially purchase. So can you, I know it's hard when you're not in person, but is there any way you can give us a quick lesson on self-arresting?
Yeah. The takeaway expression is go to the pick. When you self-arrest, you hold your ice axe in a particular fashion. Since nobody can see me, I'll try to describe it. But it's a fashion where you're holding the head of the ice axe in one hand with the pick sticking out your little finger side of your hand, of your fist. So what you do is you pull the ice axe up to your shoulder with the ice axe going diagonally across your chest. And you hold on to the far end of the ice axe down around your pants pocket. It needs to be that long. If your ice axe is too short, you're like sitting up here like a little bird on a branch and you're trying to effect a self-arrest and you've got no leverage because this thing wants to spin like that. Your ice axe will want to rotate around its head while you're self-arresting. So anyway, back to self-arrest procedure. You're gonna put all of your weight on the pick. So whatever hand happens to have the ice axe in it, when you lose your balance, slip, fall, whatever, you want to roll your body onto your ice axe with this point sticking into the snow and all of your weight on your chest driving that pick into the snow, which is therefore then going to slow you down. You're also digging in with your toes and stuff like that. You're doing everything to save your life, you know, but at least you have a tool that can penetrate the snow and get a purchase enough to slow you down. And that's why when I do my filming of how to perform the skill, I don't have my feet in the snow just so people can see what's doing the stopping is the pick.
Okay. So you're purposely making yourself fall. But not using your feet to stop yourself so you can show how effective the pick is.
Yeah. And it will only be as effective as the snow is. People go like, oh man, the thaw is on and the snow is really soft and I fell off a forester pass and I'm tumbling out of control and I went to try and self-arrest and I dug the pick in and I just kept sliding and I just kept going and going and going. And, you know, they don't stop because you're trying to pick into soup.
to soft snow.
Yeah, it ain't gonna work.
So in that case, what? How do you fix that? Do you maybe you need to like lodge your body weight more into the deeper part of the snowpack?
Jen, I love how you think, because see that was the next little teaching point, teachable moment.
I'll be your assistant, Ned.
Yeah. Just leave me in. What's interesting is that when the snow gets stupid soft like that, as soon as you like, say you want to glissade, glissading is sitting on your butt with your feet below you pointed downhill, and you want to lift your feet up and slide on your butt all the way down the hill. And it's a wonderful way to drop a few thousand feet.
It's so much fun.
Yeah.
When you do it safely, right. It's so much fun.
But when the snow becomes stupid soft, as soon as you sit down, you're what's called a sitz mark. Your butt plunges into the snow, and now your feet are up above your head, and you're not going anywhere. So if you biff it on soft snow, you're really not going to go anywhere. So there's really not a need, unless you're on some really steep pitch where you don't belong. And then you got to remember, there's probably an ice layer. See, snow packs are composed of different layers, right? Every snowfall brings 2 or 3 feet or 2 or 3 inches or whatever. Sun comes out, it melts the surface snow, it refreezes during the winter, you have an ice layer, and then more snow comes in 2 or 3 feet, whatever. So in the thaw, the surface snow melts out, but there's usually ice layers underneath. When you post hole through, say you're walking in afternoon snow, the thaw just started, it's early June, stereotypically, or traditionally, or whatever, historically. And you got like a foot of soft snow, but you're walking on something. Well, you're clearly walking on an ice layer or a frozen, compacted, consolidated snow layer that's below the soft stuff. So if you should fall, your pick isn't going to do anything in the soft stuff, but it will, by your body's weight, be driven into the harder layer underneath.
Okay. Very good answer. I feel like you've done this before. You know a little bit or something. Okay. So we have the ice axe and the ice pick explanation. What's your opinion on microspikes, crampons, maybe even snowshoes? I was going to say, I've seen on some Appalachian Trail hikers, you know, the Triple Crown, where some are doing it in really off seasons, having to carry, you know, snowshoes and whatnot. So how would through hikers know what they need to bring in regards to their shoe, their boots and the crampons and microspikes? And
okay, first of all, what you're talking about are two different things. One is flotation. The snowshoe is a flotation tool. The bigger the snowshoe, the more weight it can hold on the surface.
The larger surface area.
Yeah. And the other subject there is traction. So your crampons or microspikes are a traction subject. Snowshoes typically don't have teeth. They do now, which is great.
So I haven't seen those.
Oh God, MSR makes a great thing called the Denali Ascent or the Lightning Ascent. I think those are the ones I have. And the nice thing about them is it's a metal frame, not tubular. Tubular snowshoes like to turn into skis in a second. They simply don't have the bite. Now, tubular frame snowshoes with teeth underneath the binding or underneath your feet help a lot. But when the snow gets soft, those teeth fill up with snow and don't get a bite into the hard structures of the snowpack below. Your tubular frame wants to ride up on the soft snow. And so if you're going across a steep traverse on soft snow, your snowshoe isn't going to get a bite and it's going to want to slide sideways. And oh my God, it scares the hell out of you when they suddenly take off. So you go with it. You can go ahead and ski down the hill until you get to if you're a good skier on your snowshoes, it works just fine. But it's usually not something most people plan for, practice, perfect before they get out there. You kind of learn by a school of hard knocks. But anyway, so I have taken snowshoes at least 4 times through the Sierra for multiple month trips in May and June, sometimes earlier, sometimes later, thinking, when the snow gets soft, I'm just going to put the snowshoes on in the afternoon.
In the afternoon,
and stay on the surface and not post hole. And that does work. but it's only when you have that condition that allows it in that place, like full open sun, really soft, soupy snow. You step forward and you sink up to your groin, and it's just, you're swimming in this stuff. And you think, oh, well, I'll put my snowshoes on. Well, you know, this is like a, it's just a, it's not consistent. Let me just put it that way. The snowpack is not consistent. So you may have these pockets of, God, I can't talk. You guys get me so darn excited on the subject. I can't verbalize.
I love it.
So it doesn't really work. And what you'll find is if you follow these PCT throughs out of Kennedy Meadows or north out of Kennedy Meadows south, you'll find trash snowshoes in the bushes and alongside the trail, just because they decided, hell, I'm not carrying these damn things. I only use them once in a blue moon. And that's what I did too. I only used them once in a blue moon and regretted it every time. The better way to deal with the flotation problem after the thaw, it's not a problem before the thaw because right. It's refreezing every night. So if you're out of luck and you're in there after the thaw has kicked in and you're getting to the point where like 10 in the morning, 12 noon, you know, it's just you're post-tooling. It's like, forget it. You know, I've got to either have snowshoes, which we'll post-tool also if it gets stupid soft, or just quit for the day. You know, or go into the shade. You got to find places where the snow is colder. If you're above timberline, you're kind of screwed because there is no shade. But snowshoes have their time and place, and it's not common. So what you're going to end up doing is walking during the wee hours of the morning. You really don't want to be walking at night. We call it night hiking. But on snow, your headlamps can only go so far. And depending upon the phase of the moon and how much starlight there is, because you get up at like 3 a.m, you take off at 4, and the sun comes up, or the sky goes from black to a deep blue and progressively lighter right around 4:35. So the snow doesn't start getting soft till about 10. So you've got from, say, 4 to 10 or 6 hours at a mile an hour to try and do whatever kind of miles you can crank out. You can't go fast because if you push off your toes like one would normally do on high traction dirt or rock, you simply spin out and your foot slides backwards, and you know it's really very awkward and embarrassing because you fall down and go boom. But so you have to walk like a duck, kind of a little more flat-footed, and people go, right. Oh, hell, this is the time when you're going to put on your micro spikes, and you're absolutely correct, because now you're on a hard, quasi-frozen surface, because the temperature maybe got down to 34 degrees overnight, because, you know, it's in the thaw. So, micro spikes will work, and crampons are hiking crampons. I got to distinguish between the two for those people listening. There is a big difference between a climbing crampon and a hiking crampon. Mm-hmm. Climbing crampons have forward fangs or points that point forward from your toes, and they're designed for toeing into, you know, 40, 50, 60 degree slopes, stuff that a hiker would be scared to death on. Hikers really don't get on surfaces, the pitches, let's call them,
right,
steeper than, say, about 30, 35, maxing out at 45 degrees, and people go like, well, hell, Ned, that's nice. You know the number, but what's it look like? You know, so think of this, a sledding hill. A nice little sledding hill could be like 15, 20 degrees, maybe. So when you're looking at a slope that you have to go across as a backpacker, and you're thinking, damn, that's looking like a pretty steep sledding hill. So you're looking at something that's maybe 25, 30 degrees. And that's what I say, you know, hello, stop, get your crampons out. You need to maximize your traction. You need to maximize your balance. So make sure your snow baskets are on your poles. And you've got two decent poles that are well made for this purpose, not those wiggly little spindly summer things that are just flipping along next to your feet. When you plant your poles on snow, especially on traverses, this is where most people fall down. They don't fall down going downhill. They don't fall down going straight uphill. They fall down going across steep slopes. So if you're on a slope that looks like a great sledding hill, maybe kind of a little too much like a super sledding hill, toboggan run, you got to have the right poles, the right baskets. You got to have a self-arrest tool. You got to have traction aids. In this case, I never leave home without hiking crampons like the Cotula KTS or K10s, mm-hmm. something with some decent points underfoot. But do remember, if the snow is really soupy soft or getting there, the snow will stick to the steel, and you'll have a little half a grapefruit hanging out underneath your foot that you periodically got to knock out off so that, you know, your points will get a bite onto something. So really, you know what, even when the snow gets soft, adding crampons, it'll work for a little while, but it's going to be a pain in the ass throughout the day. But, you know, you use your pole, turn your pole upside down, bang your foot with the handle of your pole, knock the snow off, take about two more steps, and you're doing it again. So wait a minute. Nope, you can't speak yet.
Oh, you go for it.
The third level of protection are your shoes, which is actually the very first stage of snow protection. Snow balance safety protection are the types of shoes you're using, because it's where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. All of your weight is on your shoe, so your shoe's ability to even by itself, because you're not thinking yet, oh, I got to put my micro spikes on, or I got to put my hiking crampons on. You're just jamming along, and whatever you've got, you know, you packed up the tent, you got going, and you're not thinking, you're excited for the day. Suddenly you start slipping. It's because your shoes don't have deep enough lugs in their soles, in the sole pattern, to get a bite into the snow. That's where it starts. Secondly, it's the fact that if you're on a traverse, what part of your shoe is on the traverse? The traverse is, you know, somewhat steep. It's the edge of your shoe. If your edge is soft, like a trail runner, you don't have a 90-degree angle on your shoes to be able to jam in an edge. Because that's what you're doing. You're kicking in the edges of your shoes into the snow, which could be frozen in a crusty fashion in the mornings when you're up there in May or June as a through hiker going through. Soft-soled shoes will smear. It's what actually we'll call it. It's sort of a climbing term. But the edge, what you thought was, you know, I got my street hikers, I got my Salomas, I got my whatevers. And, you know, but if you take your thumb and you jam it into the edge of your shoe, is it soft? Can you actually indent the corner edge of your shoe with your finger? If you could do that, then if you stood on a sloping sidewalk in San Francisco and you put your shoes on edge, you know what I mean? They're going to round out. They're going to smear into the hard surface and turn into skis, and down you'll go. And I've seen this happen with my students who refuse to bring boots to class because it's an, oh my God, boots. I don't bring boots. I won't bring boots. They're heavy, heavy, heavy on my feet. And that's, oh my God, taboo. I will no longer be considered a righteous through hiker if I have boots. And yet as soon as they hit a slope that we have to go across, because they think they have to follow the summer switchbacks. Well, the summer switchbacks are gone. Where are switchbacks? They're on. See, if you let me go, and that I will just keep swinging from the trees with lots of good information. You do not follow the summer trail when it's buried in 5-10 feet or so.
Like for example, let's talk about Forester Pass.
Oh, goody.
So this
talk
is
about Forester.
Yeah, this is like a notorious.
Like, who is this guy? Oh my God, Dana, you can fall off your chair. Watch out.
She's loving it. So Ned, just because you're just so amazing, do you want to explain what Forester Pass is for people who don't know what it is?
Forester Pass is the first real pass that a northbound PCT through hiker, or even a John Muir Trail hiker, outside of the fact they went up Whitney to begin their trail from the top of Whitney. So they've already seen some steep stuff, actually pretty steep. But anyway, that a PCT through hiker is going to see, because up until Forester, leaving Kennedy Meadows south for the next 40, 50, 60, 70 miles, I think, up to Forester, it's rolling hills that are kind of climbing on up into, you know, from 6,000 feet to 10,000, which is the first kind of pass out of Horseshoe Meadows that they're going to go over, called Cottonwood Pass. They're going to enter Sequoia National Park, and that's where things get fun, because you now have long creek drainages that start to the east, because you're northbound, so you're going to have to cross a creek. oh, really? Well, that's no big deal, right? Because I'm walking on a flat surface. I'm just going to hop across this little thing and then just keep going. But no, you're in glaciated terrain. You've got a 800-foot drop or 600-foot drop from where you first crest over into the creek valley, and you're looking down like, whoa, that's way down there. And you've got to go all the way down those to get to the creek, which is, you know, if you're lucky and it's before the thaw, totally covered in snow. You can't see anything. It's all white. But you can see that there's no trees there. There's no trees in the creek. So, but if you're up there during the thaw, you get down to the bottom and it's like, oh my gosh, I've got this, you know, 18-foot wide, 24-foot wide creek I got to get across. But what we're getting at is those descents are the first things that the thru-hikers see. And if their shoes aren't right, they're going to have a hell of a time getting down into it, because their shoes are going to turn into skis. Getting back out, same problem. How are you going to climb back out on snow when it's a traverse all the way, you know, switchback? You make your own switchbacks, to hell with the summer ones. You do your own thing. Safer yet is to go straight up. But how do you toe in? How do you kick in with every step if your shoe is soft? You're just jamming your toes the whole way. I'm going to put on my hiking crampons. That's great if the snow will allow you, but if it's crusty, early morning, hard, you're not even going to get really that. So you got to walk flat. Anyway, so you go through a couple creek drainages on the way to Forrester. You see Forrester coming from a distance, and it looks like a wall, a big white wall.
Yes.
You know, you're above tree line. You're on Tawny Point, and you just come out of, you know, a Wallace and Wright Creek crossings, and you're getting a view of it for the first time. You're kind of going like, well, where is it? Is it that pass, or is it that pass? By the time you finally work your way up to it, it looks like a wall, and you're going like, hell no. And a lot of people do turn around.
Yeah, I'm not going up that over that. It's not happening.
No, it looks vertical, but it really isn't. It's
very intimidating. If you know, when you're standing from the back and you've never been there, it can be an intimidating but exciting view.
Yeah, even if you think it's above your skills, at least go up to the bottom of it. And realize that it's not the vertical wall. It's steep, but it's not vertical. I've measured it when I was a ski patroller for 5 years at Heavenly in Tahoe. I'm sure you've been there. We have tools for judging avalanche risks. It's called an inclinometer. Well, basically, it's a meter for measuring how steep the snow is, because most avalanches happen between like 30 degrees and 40 degrees and, you know, stuff like that, especially your body weight can set off an avalanche. So you got to know that sort of stuff. So I've taken the inclinometer up to Forrester and measured it. The bottom is kind of a slow little ramp going up. It's about 20 degrees, and about halfway up Forrester, it's about 30, 35 degrees. So it's getting steeper, and that's why you have switchbacks there. But of course, they're buried in snow. And then when you get to the chute, there's an ice chute right in the middle of the final traverse, so to speak, very top of Forrester's route up. That's about 45 degrees. And typically it's nothing but ice. But when I refer to ice, it's not like East Coast ice. It's not like a skating rink ice. It's not like an East Coast, a little pond or a lake is going to sheet up with ice and people go and play hockey on it, you know, and that kind of stuff. No, in the Sierra, you get this freeze-thaw cycle stuff going on during the day and night. So the snow gets soft and refreezes at night, so it gets crusty is what it does. So you're really walking on a frozen crust that's very rough. So therefore, if you have teeth on the bottom of your feet or lug soles, like on a boot or whatever, wearing crampons, you can get a pretty good bite, even if it's frozen crusty. But the chute in Forrester gets a lot of drippage, right, from it. There's a cornice usually on all of these passes. The cornice is an overhang of snow, and they melt, just like everything else around melts when the air gets warm. And these things drip, and then this drips in its chute right below it, and everything freezes at night. So you get this. One time I was up there, I used to chop a trail across it for everybody to use. And I was chopping away, and I got a video on YouTube somewhere. And it was about 6 inches of ice, and then you pop through into powder below. Once again, there's that layering of the snowpack. So it can be nasty, but if you have a boot track, and I'm going to get back to your first question, a boot track is a footprints where people are walking on snow, and they pound the snow down in this little track. So if you've got micro spikes and you can walk in an established boot track, yep, there's been 30, 40, 50 people ahead of me over the last 3 weeks. There'll be a trail to follow, because on where there's no visible trail, you don't know where you're going. You don't have trail signs. You don't have anything. Everything's buried. So what they do, because they don't know where they're going, they're going to follow footprints. So if you have a boot track, the track will be flat, even on a traverse. Mm-hmm. Oh, that makes it really great. That's very nice. Yes, very nice. So if you have micro spikes, use them. But don't expect your micro spikes to work if you step out of the track. Say you lose your balance and you got to step sideways suddenly. If you step out of the track and onto a steeper slope, your micro spikes may just roll right off your foot and disappear. Yeah. Then you have no traction at all and down you go. So stay in the track if you have micro spikes. If you don't have a boot track, get hiking crampons and in regular boots, because you're not going to have a flat track to walk on all the time. You're going to be on varying pitches.
And that's great. You know, I hiked in 2018 when it was like, we'll say a normal slash low snow year. Obviously there was still snow. I wore trail runners the entire time and I did have micro spikes, but I could see how difficult that would be in a high snow year where you don't have the support like what you're talking about. Uh-uh. So it's certain, people have this idea of like, oh, thru-hikers wear trail runners because it's lighter and we'll say cooler, whoever made that up. But maybe this is the year where, you know, you need to be smarter and wear better boots and carry or heavier, maybe ice axes, and just kind of like what you're talking about. And because, you know, when I went up Forester Pass, it was snowy, but there were switchbacks. I didn't have like a straight, you know, shot up there.
Okay. I remember now. You said something and I said, I disagree with you there. But what I'm getting at here is that if there is a boot track, yeah, you can have your trail runners with micro spikes because it's flat. If there's no, even if without fresh snow, even if, you know, you get 40, 50 people going ahead of you, they're going to pound out a flat track on a traverse. But if there isn't that, then you do need to have some teeth underneath your feet with a decent edge. So the problem, actually, what we're having right now, what the thru hikers are having, and this is what I want to, I think of the other point, there were two points regarding what you said. And I said, you said, if there's a lot of snow, oh my God, there's so much snow right now. It doesn't make any difference. I don't care if there's 3 feet of snow out there or there's 30 feet of snow out there regarding the boot track. There's still going to be 3 feet of snow on that steep traverse that a bunch of people are going to pound in a track going across. It's going to look exactly the same if there's 30 feet versus 3 feet. You're going to look at a white slope with snow on it that has an angle and a boot track.
Just imagine being the first person.
Hello.
You. That's you.
I usually am.
But see, I know.
Through hikers think that, oh, I'm going to go from Mexico to Canada. I'm going to walk through all kinds of stuff. And that's why it's called a through hike. You know, I got a national forest and I've got high elevations and low elevations, and it's going to be a grand adventure. They don't realize that they're going to have environmental changes ranging from desert to rain to snow to pitches to ice. And right now they're sitting at Kennedy Meadows South, at least the leaders of the band, and they're thinking, oh, crap, I have to carry not only more gear and more clothing, but I have to carry more food because there are no resupply locations that would be available. They were available in my guidebook. Oh, the roads are closed because of rock avalanches and snow avalanches, and the roads to the trailheads that I would take to get into town are closed. I have to, you know, like if someone wanted to go out from Kennedy Meadows South, you go about 3 or 4 days north to Cottonwood Pass. And if you want to resupply, you can head east about 4 or 5 miles to the trailhead, to the parking lot, and hitch a ride. If the road was open. Oh my God, the road's not open. What am I going to do? It's about a 21 something mile road walk, downhill, steep, blister time, bloody feet, the whole mess, you know, just to get down to Lone Pine to resupply and then turn around with a full pack and go back. Are you kidding? Yeah. So they go, they're realizing, oh, Kennedy Meadows, all right, can't resupply there, can't resupply next time. Kearsarge. Oh, shit. Okay. I got to go to Kearsarge Pass. Okay. Kearsarge Pass is 1 mile an hour, 10 days north.
Yeah, I think that was like 10, 11 days for me. I got off at Kearsarge. Yeah, you're going, it's all snow.
Oh, yeah.
Low miles, you have to carry more. So there's just all of these.
But there's a volume problem. They know, okay, I got to carry all this more stuff. I got to carry more fuel because I'm melting snow because there's no creeks, there's no lakes, there's nothing. It's just snow. So they got to carry more junk, more things to stay alive out there. They have litty bitty packs because they were told, oh no, I can't have a certain pack of a certain amount of weight. So they have these itty bitty packs because they resupply every 3 or 4 days going through towns, crossing, you know, Southern California, roadways, whatever. What, how are they going to do it? They don't have the ability to carry the volume and the weight they need to go and do what they're looking at doing.
And I think that's a good point, because especially with like social media, and we'll call them influencers, that horrible word, and just people, you know, just you. Okay, if you look at the pack you carried in 1974 versus what some of these ultralight hikers carry now, it is maybe we can get some, like, if you have some pictures, like a side, you know, side by side comparison, the amount of gear that was carried is nowhere near what it's carried today.
Nowhere near.
And
because of
you know, maybe yeah, and maybe some you know companies are they're learning how to combine, you know, like you're like the trekking pole and the self-arrestic, they're learning how to maybe combine certain equipment, so things are getting maybe through research lighter and, you know, more durable. And but the problem is, I think a lot of hikers are trying to get a low base weight and do that whole thing, but they're not gonna succeed, or it's gonna be very difficult and it'll be very unsafe if they go into these conditions and thinking that lighter is better. And so I think you bring up a lot of good points. And I really appreciate that.
Don't get me wrong, Jen. Lighter is better. It's more comfortable on the body and trauma.
Yes.
Every step, shockwaves through the body, you know, the more weight, the worse it is. But once you get stronger, see, this is the thing. If you're going out as a weekend warrior, definitely light. You know, your body's not trail strong, what I call trail strong yet. But after about 5 days, you're off the Advil finally, you know, your body's starting getting stronger. Muscles are waking up to the task at hand, you know, cartilage, ligaments, everything's going to get stronger. It's what the body does. And so you'll be able to, in a short period of time, certainly by 5-6 weeks down the road when you hit Kennedy Meadows South, add on more weight. They really have got to, it's good to start light because your body's not able to take the weight.
Right.
But later, once it can, add on safety stuff, add on convenience stuff. You can. And don't tell anybody your weight, your pack weight. Oh my God.
Oh my goodness. Well, there's another question I wanted to ask you about, and obviously hiking through the mountains, there's a lot of frozen bodies of water, but right now a lot of them are covered in snow.
Definitely.
But just in general, what if, like, do you have any tips for, you know, if you have to cross a frozen body of water or, yeah, would that ever be something that would happen on the Pacific Crest Trail? And,
oh yeah.
And yeah, so like, what are some tips? How do you know that, you know, you can cross over ice safely?
First of all, the problem will exist wherever it's starting to thaw out, wherever the temperatures are warm and the snow is getting soft and all that kind of junk. I mean, think about it. This is what happens in the Sierra compared to the East Coast. In the beginning of the winter, lakes and creeks, well, let's just talk lakes. Lakes will skin up with ice. And just the ice will get thicker and thicker because there's not a whole lot of snow, maybe back east, you know, in general. I'm going to compare. What happens in the Sierra, though, yeah, the lakes skin up in the fall, winter, you know, November, December. Get ice right there. John Ditley gets out there and starts skating, ice skating on all these 12,000-foot in elevation lakes that are miles long and stuff. I mean, it's awesome. Incredible amphitheaters. He's out there ice skating. It's great. But then put 20 feet of snow on top of that. No ice is going to hold that amount of weight. So what happens? The ice breaks. Water rushes back up through the cracks in the ice, fill the snow, or at least a good bit of it. And it refreezes. So what you have come May for what the thru hikers are going to see is a 3 or 4 feet usually of frozen water impregnated snow. I mean, it's just rock hard. You have to use your ice axe to chip through it to try and get some water to backfill up from the lake. You're not standing on the lake chipping or digging a hole to try and get some water out of it. You may be digging for quite a while after a winter like this one, but that's the way the lakes go. So when they start thawing out, you'll notice that the color of the snow will change from white to kind of a gray or a light blue, a light gray or a light blue, meaning that there's more water in the snowpack below the surface. It won't be uniform. It'll be scattered all over the surface of the lake. Matter of fact, you might even have ponding going on where there's these big puddles of water and you think, oh crap, look at the hole in this hole in the snow and that's the lake, but it isn't. It's the wrong color. You walk right up to it and you look down and it's like, foot deep of water and it's just clear. You can see the snow underneath it. So those are typical signs. I have an expression that I teach my students to walk on white. Wherever the snow is white rather than gray or a light blue, it's thicker. The snow is thicker. And so therefore, your feet won't be as close to softer, wetter snow, and the snow will be harder. And it's actually, you'll test it with your poles. You probe ahead and see how soft or how hard it is and walk where it's hard. But it's not like you're going to suddenly break through that 3-foot layer of frozen slushy whatever snow. It's thick. Now creeks, the next stage that they're going to see as the lakes start to thaw out will be perimeter cracking. There'll be cracks that'll form going around the lake where the lake meets rock. You've seen those things, and they'll crack out and they'll be 2 or 3 inches wide, and you look down them and it's looking like down a crevasse and it goes down like 5 feet, and you go like, well, I still don't see any water down there. What gives? Because of all the snow. What's going on is the snow is settling over the lake. The lake, it's beginning to sink, and so it breaks away from the snow that isn't sinking on rock. And you get this perimeter cracking. And then you get running cracks that run across the lake. It still doesn't mean you can't walk on it. You just have to judge and know what you can walk on and what you can't. Remember, you got 3 or 4 feet of this mass underneath your feet. Now creeks. Creeks are a little different because they're moving. When water is moving, air is also moving above them. So what happens in reality, and this happens actually on the trail bed also. If you've ever walked from dirt onto snow and you're following a trail, the trail will run under the snowpack, right? Well, it doesn't just like it's actually, God, I don't know how to verbally describe it. I'd like to show it with my hands, but this isn't video. Air will actually blow along the bed of the trail because it's concave and get up on underneath the snowpack and hollow it out. That's why you never walk on snow on top of the trail if the snow is shallow, because you'll simply suddenly pop through and jar your back and spine as you drop 6-8 inches or 1.5 feet and land on dirt. And that's just not bueno. It's not good. So, oh God, where was I going with that? Creek.
I don't know, but I'm on this ride and I love it.
I just get going. So if I lose track, you got to take me back. It's like, okay, Teach, you left off at, Okay. So creeks will thin because of this wind and water movement. When everything is frozen, March, April, beginning of May, depending upon how the spring goes. So the secret season, everything refreezes at night. You got about a month, the month of May usually. There's about 4 inches of water in the creeks. These massive summer creeks have only 4 inches of water when everything is frozen and nothing is melting. There's still a little bit of water, and in some places you may even see what I call open water, or these little windows through the snow where you can go, hey, look down there. I can actually see the. But if you don't have a tube to drop down 4 or 5 feet or whatever to into the water to pump the water out, and you sure as heck can't dip your canteen way down there, you're kind of screwed. Anyway, you see there's water, say, hi, water, you can't get it. you know, but what you have to do to get the water is create stairs. You have to create steps that are secure to get you down to the water's edge. So it's a little bit of construction. You learn how to do it and junk like that. But if you have open water, so you're going to have early on, you're going to have these hollowed out creeks, but there's not a whole lot of volume. So if, for example, you're standing on a snow bridge and you know that everything's really frozen, but you suddenly drop, the whole area will just drop, like you're sitting on a record or a big sheet of plywood or a something as big as your car, and the whole thing will drop about 2 feet, you know, or whatever was the thickness of the airspace above the 4 inches of water. And you go like, oh God, that was a quick elevator descent. You know, it's like, and you're looking at your buddies standing nearby and you're all laughing like, what the heck just happened? That's all it was. You just had a fracture in that area. You dropped the snow that you were standing on, which could be 4 or 5 feet thick, just dropped down onto the rocks of the creek bed. You know, a little bit of water is running down there and you're standing on 4 feet of snow. Big deal. Step off of it and get up back onto the snow bank and move on. As it thaws out, though, the more and more water is going to fill the creek. You're going to have not only more water, but you're going to have more splashing going on. So therefore, more water, which is warmer than snow, will splash up and hollow out these caverns. It's not that they get huge. The air spaces, some of the biggest ones I've seen were only about 2 or 3 feet or so, you know. But if you fell in one and there was sufficient water volume, you might get carried underneath the snowpack and die. So that's not cool. Now, some people have been able to grab rocks and stop themselves and then try and climb or crawl back to the opening that they fell through and extricate themselves. But you can, you know, if there's enough water volume, that may not happen. And that's going to be, you know, like the famous national Kings Canyon National Park Ranger, Randy Morganson, who died that way. He, you know, 30 years in the backcountry, he knew what he was doing. But I don't know, maybe, you know, even the pros forget to notice a slight sign in the snow, and he should have noticed it was soft there or whatever is near a bush. And he fell through and he unfortunately passed away. But so
yeah,
when creeks start to thaw out, you're going to see these peripheral cracking. You're going to see depressions where there weren't depressions before. You're going to see color changes again. You're going to hear the creek. It's like you're just starting your descent down into, say, Rock Creek or Tyndall or Crabtree, which is Whitney Creek, or some of these other big creeks, and you're 700 feet up or 500 feet above it, and you hear it roaring, and it's like, what? You know, well, probably there won't be any snow on it anymore because the snow will muffle the creek. So the louder it is, the more open water. So if you're standing on a creek that's covered with snow and you hear the creek underneath your feet, tell yourself, hello, brain, remember,
it's connect less, the dots.
Yeah, there's less snow underfoot because you can hear the water. Get the hell off of the snow and get up the bank before the whole thing drops as a unit. Once again, you don't get out there without checking in advance. Walk on white. Don't cross the gray stuff, the light blue stuff. I don't care if you have to walk 50 feet, 50, you know, quarter mile to find a decent thickness snow bridge. You know, there's pockets of open water.
You have to really think when you're in those situations, and, you know, not always take, maybe we'll say, the lazy way, just because, you know, you'll go, I can just, you know, make it right there. You know, you need to make those smart decisions. And what I really appreciate about you, Ned, is you obviously are very educated and you're very confident in subjects that I think make a lot of people nervous. And so your mountain education organization is a way for you to help educate people like me and so many others become less anxious and nervous about facing these kinds of situations.
Right.
Would you mind just like briefly talking about mountain education, what it is, how it got started, and what you provide, and, you know, how others can follow you?
There's a lot of information in there, Jen.
I'll try and
follow that one. Okay. So remember I told you the story of those five college kids on San Jacinto in 1974, thought they were going to die. I rescued them and told them how to get back down to Idlewild, the parking lot at the trailhead. And I mean, they were so hypothermic, they were near death. At least two of the girls were. They had shorts, t-shirts, tennis shoes. They weren't thinking snow. Anyway, I came away from that experience thinking, oh my God, this is too beautiful a setting for people to die in just because they're trying to go out and recreate and have fun and see something beautiful. And it's like, here now they're gonna die. I said to myself, I said, somebody's got to create some kind of a school. I didn't really know. We didn't have the internet. I didn't know what was out there already. Like National Outdoor Wilderness, National Outdoor Leadership School, or NOLS. They were already in existence. Paul Petzold started that with kind of the same idea. You know, teach people what the realities are out there. You know, where you start at 4,000 feet may not be, those conditions there may be hot in summer, like, but where you're going, it could be, you know, God, Back to the Future, that scene, you know, where we're going, there are no roads. We don't need tires, you know, and he flies away. So, you know, you got to think about where you're going. It's, oh, look at the book. It says it's a little line and it's on a flat piece of paper. So maybe the trail is flat. No, it's going to have ups and downs. But you try and educate folks. So I started mountain education back in 1982 to convey what I knew. It to this day is still 100% free. It's a public charity, 501c3, tax deductible, IRS, blah, blah, blah. But whatever I put out there, whether it's an in-person class or it's a meetup or it's a what we're doing right now, and you have all this great information, and some people are going to go, oh, you should put that behind a paywall and you should make some money. No, because the whole point is to train up people so that they can have that knowledge first to gain the experience necessary to be safe out there as they're testing themselves, as they're testing the gear to find out if it really works for them, to be safe. You see, I want people to fall in love with what I love. So how do you do that? You either take them out there, or if you can't, you tell them how, and you show them pictures and you show them videos, but you got to be real about it. So many videos, teaching videos I see, I don't know what the hell they're talking about. And they're talking about these specialty terms and climbing things and whatever. And it's like, I make it as simple and down to earth as possible. I used to teach an EMT class or emergency medical technician. You know, if you want to work in an ambulance, if you want to progress toward becoming a nurse or a paramedic or something, that's the EMT level. I used to teach that at a community college in South Lake Tahoe. Great school, by the way. But anyway, you know, you look at your students. You got 30 of them in the room. You're trying to describe what it's like to assess someone and to see if they're, you know, suffering from altitude sickness, or they're suffering from hypothermia or dehydration because they all look the same, or any of a number of other things. And they're going like, I can't relate to you. I don't know what the hell you're talking about, teach. So then you gotta, you know, you see the quizzical expressions, and you, all right, let me rephrase. You know, this is what you're going to see. You're going to see somebody that's slurring their words. You're going to see somebody who was normal colored and now they're more white. Or maybe they're even, their cheeks are getting red as the body, and they're shivering. Their body's trying to respond naturally to create heat. Or like a ski patroller top of Heavenly at 10,000 feet. People go from lake level at 6. They don't realize the chairlift is taking them up 4,000 feet. They get to the top and they're going like, oh God, I have a headache. And they come bang on our door at the ski patrol shack and go like, oh, what's going on? And we know, we see it all the time, but they don't know. So mountain education is all about giving people the tools they need to stay safe and savvy out there and have fun. It's 100% free. We just redid our website, so not everything is on it that used to be on it, but we're adding to it all the time. I got a great IT gal, webmaster, etc. Unfortunately, we're making about $10 a day, so we're really not able to do a whole lot, you know. But we try and get the word out, and I love what you're doing. I love the fact that we can get the word out and to help your people too.
Yeah, you know, Ned, I think it's absolutely amazing that I didn't fully realize that was all free.
Yeah,
all of your lessons, and I see you posting even on Facebook because you have. You can also go to like Mountain Education Inc. on like you have a Facebook page, and you're constantly sharing information there and in Pacific Crest Trail groups, and I'm sure various hiking groups. So we will be putting your website and all the applicable information in the description of this podcast episode, So if any listeners want to, you know, donate or take a class or whatever, all that information will be there and we will be sharing it for you, because I really appreciate that, because you're doing it. You can tell that you are passionate about this. You care that people are getting out there and enjoying the beauty and make it out alive. And that is the point. So thank you so much for, you know, creating something like that. And when I'm back out in Reno and South Lake Tahoe, I'll be taking some of your classes. So you better be prepared for me to show up. I have one question real quick, though. This is probably the most important question this whole time is, have you ever eaten yellow snow?
Hell no. Are you kidding? Even every little teenager knows about that one. Ah, but how about red snow?
Yes. Actually, that's not good. That's dangerous.
Oh, yeah. That's bacteria or something like that. That's not
something.
Good. Stay away
from
that. So if you're melting snow, scrape that stuff off the side. It's only on the surface, along with dead mosquitoes and twigs and other stuff that's blown in, and get the clean snow from underneath. But I was going to say, I'm on Facebook under Ned Tibbetts. I try and keep that more wilderness-related safety stuff comments, but not the school. The school is at Mountain Education, Inc. on Facebook, and there I talk about real education stuff and PCT-centric, Continental Divide, long-distance stuff. And then the website is, you know, www.mountaineducation.org, and that's where I'm at.
Great. Yeah. Thank you so much. We will, like I said, we will be putting all of that in the description. And when we share it out and ping it to everybody, we'll be including all of your Facebook and website and everything. So hopefully that helps and gets the word out, because what you're doing is really valuable. And it's not your day job. You work somewhere else. So it's not like you're doing this as a passion project on the side. So.
Oh yeah. 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 So, this is my side hustle.
Your side hustle. I've just had such a great time talking to you. I could sit here, talk to you for hours. I'm sure in the future we're going to talk some more. Final word, is there any last thing you would like to say before we log off?
God, no.
There's actually a lot. I mean,
we talked about a lot. I appreciate the platform and the opportunity.
Right.
God, you know, I think the only thing, the takeaway expression really is, do your research, everyone, before you get too excited and blinded by what we call summit fever or destination fever or whatever. It's like, rah, rah, let's go, you know, hit the trail. You know, find out what the conditions are like, where you're going, and dress and plan for that. You know, it's like, do I need to put the chains in the car because I know I'm going up in the snow country? You know, you got to know that. So,
right. Yeah. Great. Well, thank you so much, Ned. It has been so enjoyable talking to you, and I know this won't be the last time.
Sweet. I love it. Let's do it again.